Good morning, everybody. This is the Launch Hour with Ron Reardon and Jim DeBetta. Jim is off today, and we also have Lee Cantor.
And good morning to you, Ron. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. How about you?
I am okay. It's fired up. The weather's starting to be nice. You been out there exercising?
I've been out there pulling weeds.
That's exercising, yeah. Counts.
Until the mosquitoes drove me away.
You already got mosquitoes? I haven't seen that many.
Yep.
So what do we have on tap today?
Okay, we have a very special guest today. It's Brownell Landrum. Hi, Brownell.
Hi, Ron.
So I understand that you've launched several ventures, and the ones that I know about, it's a restaurant, a game, and a book. Could you talk to us a little bit about the first one?
Yeah, the first was a restaurant. I came from corporate America, like a lot of people, and it was in 2004 when the company I was working for was having major layoffs every 6 months. And so it was not that hard to predict that that day could come, and it was a smart thing to do to think, what's my plan B?
Okay. And what was your plan B?
My plan B, well, actually what I did is I took a whole list of ideas, probably about a dozen or more business ideas, because I knew it would be entrepreneurial. I knew it wasn't going to be going out and finding a job. And so I took about a dozen business ideas, and then I actually created a matrix to look at all the ideas and rate them on how viable they were.
Right.
You know, whether it was something that could be sold. So that if you're going to build a business, you want something you can build that you can actually sell at the end of the day that's not all about you.
Okay. And how did the restaurant appear on top?
Yeah, it did. It appeared on top because I had lots of different – well, because it was sellable. It was something I could sell. It was something I could franchise, which mm-hmm. was another thing on the list. It was a unique idea, which is something that I wanted to make sure that, you know, it was
right.
really different. No one had done before. It was also something that I could do uniquely. I had quite a bit of background in the marketing aspect of restaurants, whether it was from an ad agency standpoint, internally within a restaurant organization, or actually with Coca-Cola. I worked with all the major restaurant chains. So I knew the industry pretty
right.
well, even though I'd never operated a restaurant before.
Right. Details.
Yeah, details.
You don't want to get bogged down by that.
Something simple like that, yeah.
And what was unique about this restaurant?
Well, there were a lot of things that I did that were very unique, and I'm still really proud of it, even though, as you know on your list, if there's other things on my list, that means I'm not still doing the restaurant. It was called Wrap and Roll, and it was basically wraps and rolls. And it was kind of like an international Moe's, if you will. It had about 25 international sauces, and so you could really kind of make it anything. All the menu items were named after songs, so that was really fun. Mm-hmm. So I had like a mushroom roll called Dark Side of the Moon.
That's good.
You know, and I had Addicted to Love was one of the wraps and things like that. So I had all the menu items pretty much at the same price, which is unusual. A lot of things that I did really differently from what's out there. And I still think it was ahead of its time. And
yeah.
I think I was in an area geographically that was probably not ready for it, if
yeah,
that
I was,
makes sense.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, they always say location, location, location. How did you feel about the location that you had?
Well, you know, that's the hardest part about the restaurant business, if you ask me, is finding a location. Because they're very restricted about where you can go. There's almost always already a restaurant there, and you need to have a certain amount of parking that's always accessible.
Right.
And they always lock out things. Like Chipotle likes to lock out anything that has to do, not just with Mexican, but with wraps or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really tough to find a location. I was really happy with the location moving in. But I just, you know, even though my background's marketing, I just didn't really think through the demographics and think, there wasn't anything really funky and hip in that area. It was very, they thought Subway was really cool.
Right.
And hip.
The exotic.
You know? Yeah. Subway was the exotic. So I didn't pick the best demographic area. I also didn't pick a great area for dinner, but I didn't expect to have to worry about dinner business. I think it's probably today, it's probably a better location than it was because it was over near where the new Symphony Hall is or
mm-hmm.
Performing Arts Center or whatever in Cobb County.
Right.
In Smyrna. So, I mean, it actually probably has gotten better now, but I didn't have the wherewithal to wait it out.
Did you bring in people that were restaurant people as part of your team?
I hired an expert chef to come up with all the menu items, and then I also hired, and actually he helped me hire the chef that I hired. I designed it to be a chain from the beginning. So I actually had a central kitchen that was doing all the cooking and then delivering it to the restaurant location. So I was already designing it to be multiple locations. You know, in the end of the day, I mean, I had people fly out from California to franchise the state of California. So it could have just done huge. It just didn't.
Yeah. Well, I know that a friend of mine that's very successful in restaurants and all like that talks about the very first restaurant that he was a part of, and it was over on Jimmy Carter. And when he opened it up, nobody came in. Day after day after day, the waiters were sleeping on the tables. I mean, there was just no clients. And he finally put on a gorilla suit with a big sign and went walking up and down Jimmy Carter to get people to come into the restaurant.
Oh, wow.
And did that turn the tide?
Yeah, it really did. And, you know, people started coming in because they're, you know, looking at, where's what's this gorilla thing, you know? But, yeah, now he, you know, it's the fellow that owns Frontier Tex-Mex and, you know, a lot of other stuff. Yeah, he's very successful now.
That's funny. You know, I used to threaten my employees if they were late, I'd make them dress up in some costume. See? And stand out.
Once again, ahead of your time. Should have followed through with that.
Should have followed through. No, I broke even on the 15th day.
Oh, wow.
I had huge traffic. I had huge lunch traffic. I just didn't have enough dinner traffic to sustain the rest of it. If I had just a little more dinner traffic, I would have totally done okay.
Wow.
And weekend, I didn't have any weekend traffic.
That's incredible. Yeah, the location is really important. And so what happened after the restaurant?
Well, obviously, the restaurant didn't make it for a number of reasons.
Can we talk a little bit about that aspect of it? Because I think that's an important aspect for people that have a business or an idea, that you're doing it and you're seemingly doing well initially, and then you get to a point where how do you decide when you've had enough?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's the decision of when you've had enough, and there's also the decision of what, you know, looking back and say, what did I learn and what could I have done differently? And there's kind of two aspects to that. When I had enough was when the money ran out. And that leads to kind of the question of, well, what did I do wrong? And obviously I underestimated the amount of money that I would need.
Right.
But I went in, what was interesting about it is I went in really absolutely certain, whether it was my intuition or my higher power or whatever you want to call it, knowing that I should not bring in a partner to help invest in with me. I should do it all on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my downfall at the same time. But then kind of in retrospect, it's also, I'm kind of glad that somebody else didn't go down with me, if that makes sense. It was, you know, it was my trial, it was my failure, it was my risk, it was my, you know, my learning, and no one else had to be, you know, had to go with me, if you will.
Right.
And I tell people that any new venture is like planting English ivy. The first year that you plant English ivy, it's sleeping. The second year, it's creeping. And the third year, it's leaping. And restaurants or any other venture go through that. I call that first stage the desert of despair. And you have to have enough finances to get through people knowing that you're there and getting traction and getting some momentum and, like you said, getting the traffic.
Yeah.
Is that a rule of thumb about it? It takes about a year before you see any kind of inkling of hope?
It's not necessarily a year, but it goes through those three stages.
Uh-huh.
You know, the first year of my business was just really grim. I think I had about four clients.
But what kept you going and not saying, you know what, this is, you know, at some point you have to go, you got to look in the mirror and say, this isn't working, I got to pull the plug. I mean, it's one thing where you have so much money and you run out of money, then it becomes kind of obvious. But how do you know where, like, maybe I'd be better served doing something else?
That's a tough call.
Because, you know, that's a little bit of faith in this. You know, you have the belief of what you believe in what you're doing, or else you wouldn't have attempted it. You know, and how do you know, like, to say, you know what, maybe I ought to put my energy somewhere else that I'd get more traction.
Yeah, because, you know, Henry Ford said that most people stop just inches from great success.
Right, and you just never know if great success is around the corner. So how did you go about, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to stick with it even though things look tough? And then in your case, Brownell, you said, you know what, I ran out of money, so I'm going to have to do something else.
Right, right. Well, it's like, it's the funny, there's you know, the quote, it's always darkest before the dawn.
Right.
But then there's a, I don't know if you all know despair.com with the posters.
Right.
But they have one that says, it's always darkest before it goes pitch black.
Right.
That's my favorite quote, yes.
That's the one you're like, okay, sometimes it's always darkest before it goes pitch black.
It's not getting light anytime soon.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the example a lot of people give is the what they call the pump in the desert, where you come up to this pump and you have some water and you prime it and you start pumping and you're sweaty and nothing but air is coming out of the pump, and you keep pumping, you know, out of faith. And if you could see a cross section of the earth, you could see this cool water coming up the pipe. Okay, and if you quit pumping, then it's going to go back down.
Right.
And but it's a tough call to say, you know, there's this, you know, this pump is just not going to produce.
Right.
Versus, you know, if I just give it a little bit more effort, I'm very, very close. That water's almost at the surface.
Right.
And it's hard. It's a hard decision.
And part of it, I think, one of the factors in that is that you have to decide how much you're willing to sacrifice. I think one of the problems with people coming from corporate, for example, and they're used to a certain paycheck and a certain amount of benefits and everything, they think, well, I've got to maintain my lifestyle. I've got to maintain this, this, and this.
Right.
And they get real spoiled in that versus thinking, like with my current business, I mean, I was homeless for 2 years while I was building it. That's how much I was willing to sacrifice. That's a bigger, that's a big decision to make that decision.
That's true.
Right. And I, kicking and screaming, I would have gone to go try to do something else in the meantime. So I learned from the first experience to say, what are you really willing to sacrifice for it? Because it's not necessarily going to be cushy. And you're going to say, like you said, it might start sleep and then creep and then leap. And are you really willing to, how much, how important is it to you?
Yeah. Because I know with my business, Patents and More, that that first year was very, very grim. You know, I did what I thought was everything right, and it just wasn't happening. And so right there towards the end, you know, my wife is questioning me, is like, you know, is this really going to happen? And I'm sitting there starting to have doubts myself. And then luckily, you know, January came, and the phone just started ringing off the hook. And I'm just like, whew, I don't have to go get a job.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think it was, Ron, that got the phone to start ringing? Was it just all that those kind of seeds you had planted that just started coming into fruition?
Yeah, the seeds finally started planting. I did a lot of things wrong, put a lot of money into advertising and promotion that was just a total waste. And the one thing I did right was develop relationships with people that were already credible and in the industry that started referring clients to me.
Mm-hmm. And then so I guess once you – It's important to look back periodically to see where you're going right and where you're going wrong. So then you can now, instead of reinvesting that money in advertising, you said, I'm going to reinvest in these relationships
right.
and build a better network of relationships to feed me business.
Yeah, it was one of the things that I knew that I should have applied more because the Hershey Candy Company, the old man Hershey that started it, never spent a nickel on advertising. He said that word of mouth advertising was the best. And it wasn't until he died that actually, you know, his successors started doing some traditional advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Okay, so after the restaurant, then what?
So after the restaurant, I went through all the horror stories. So I'm the cautionary tale in some regard, I guess. But
was there a period of mourning, like where you really felt bad and you felt like a failure? Did you go through any of that?
Enormous crisis. Because, you know, not to put too, you know, personal point on it, but I mean, I felt really spiritually guided to do the restaurant, and I felt really spirit, and it was a deep spiritual crisis as well as
right.
a deep financial crisis. I mean, I had to file bankruptcy. My house was going to foreclose. Also in the middle of all that, I had a relationship end, and a guy left me, and my dog had to be put to sleep. So, I mean, all of that was happening
oh, my
at
goodness.
Once. It was really the bottom of the barrel, you know, and complete lack of hope for anything because I couldn't imagine going back to corporate, but I just never thought I could ever do another business.
Right.
But what was interesting is that with the bankruptcy law, it strongly discourages you to look for work while you're going through bankruptcy because if you do, you have to pay everything back. It switches you back to the other kind of bankruptcy.
So look for work like a job or look
yeah.
for work to start a new business?
Well, either, really. But anyway, if you're not making income, the way the bankruptcy law works, if you're not making any income, then you can't – If you start making income while the bankruptcy is going through its proceedings, then you actually switch to the other kind of bankruptcy. You switch to Chapter 7, and Chapter 7 you have to pay it back.
Right.
In Chapter 13 you don't. And I had not earned any income from the restaurant, so I was qualifying for the don't have to pay
right.
anybody back.
And
that was a lot of money.
You wanted to stay on that train.
I wanted to stay on that train, exactly. Frankly, it wouldn't have been that easy anyway. But what it did was give me a lot of time for that soul searching and
mm-hmm.
a lot of time for that depression. But actually, it led me to write my book, which I know you've got on the list to ask me about, and you've
That's
got a
right.
copy right in front of you.
Yeah, I bought one.
And
Five Reasons Why Bad Things Happen, How to Turn Tragedies into Triumph, Brown L. Landrum.
Yep. And that was by far the most powerful experience of my life was writing that book. I mean, I was in the highest level bliss that one can imagine. I couldn't wait to get out of bed to write it. I'd go out and I couldn't wait to come home to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And literally I was losing my house and everything that was going around me. But while I was writing that book, it was just an extremely powerful experience.
Goodness. So, well, what are the five reasons?
It's not that easy.
Not all five. Just, you know, save a couple for the people who buy the book.
Well, yes, exactly. Well, because, you know, actually one of the guidance is, you know, it's a 426-page book. So it's not like, you know, you can just go say, oh, here are the five reasons on one page and
right.
walk away. But what it does do is, so the hints are, you know, there is a big reason why, and that they all have in common, and that is something that needs to change, and or that it's leading you toward change. And I think that's one of the things that people need to look at. Like you said, Lee, when do you decide to leave that concept or leave that business? When do you decide what change do you need to make? And they look at how are you handling the crisis? Are you, are you looking for things to change, or are you blaming other people? They look at things that you might have done that caused it, whether it was within your own subconscious or whether it was somebody, something you've done to somebody else in the past.
Right.
So it really, and then also, of course, it looks at the obvious, which, most people want to look at that chapter right away, which is there a reward in it? Is it going to lead you somewhere better?
Yeah, because I think it was Napoleon Hill that said that in every adversity, there's a seed of a greater goodness.
And I believe that, too, but I also believe that it's not necessarily. In other words, I think there's an opportunity for greater goodness.
Right.
But you have to go through the lessons. I'm very much a big believer that if you don't understand the why something happened, whether it's a physical illness or it's, a business failure or, legal issue or whatever it is, unless you get to the why, you can't get to the healing.
Right. Because, I've got twin boys, Drew and Eric, and when they were teenagers, 15, 16, and occasionally making mistakes and everything, my mantra with them was, well, what did you learn from that?
Exactly.
And what are you going to do differently next time?
Well, and the only thing I'd add to that is, why do you think it happened?
Yeah.
It's fascinating when you ask somebody that question. No, most people would not even know. Even they look at you like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Why did my child get born with this disease? Or why did I get put in prison wrongly? Or why did I get sick, or whatever it is, or why did my business fail? Mm-hmm. And so I think you have to, when you ask that question, it's very interesting when you start getting the answers, how powerful that answer can be.
When you were talking to people, were they, when bad things do happen to people, what percentage of people kind of blame it on external things that are out of their control, as opposed to the people that take responsibility for at least a portion of it?
Well, that's really interesting, actually. Rabbi Kushner, who wrote When Bad Things Happen to Good People,
right,
read my book. And his take on my book was a fascinating response, because basically he thinks it's all random. Just he doesn't think that anything happens for a reason. And I'm saying, no, it all happens for a reason, and very definitively happens for a reason.
Right.
But there's a lot of research that after he read it and came back, I wrote the preface with him in mind, because I thought, well, wait a minute, what's the difference? Why would some people think it's random and some people think it's on purpose?
Right.
And the really one of the big interesting parts of the research was that people who believe things happen for a reason are a lot happier than those who don't.
Okay.
So it's a significant contribution to happiness is to believe that there is some, like you said, control. If there's a reason, then there's some control.
Even if the reason is you're blaming someone else?
Well, you still have to go. There's still you can sit there and go, okay. In fact, one of the things I talk about, I have 9 basic assumptions in the book, and the first one is that there's a higher power. Mm-hmm. And I say, you have to believe these assumptions, because I'm not going to talk you into believing that there's a higher power. You either
right.
have to believe it or not.
Right.
But the second one is that it's a loving higher power. So if you think it's a vengeful, wrathful being, then the book is not going to mean anything to you. You're going to want to blame God or a wrathful
God. Right, no matter
God.
What. Right.
Right. But I'm saying that even if you say, like a friend of mine, his car was stolen, and he's like, oh, the evil in the world, these people stealing the cars. Like, no, it happened to you for a reason.
Right.
Not just this person randomly stole your car. It happened to you for a reason. So if it's your experience, it's your reason.
And I think there are people, though, that would say, we create a reason in order to justify it. That there wasn't a reason, we just create one in order to justify it in our mind.
And you know what? Even if that's true, and it may be true, it mm-hmm. still makes you happier.
True.
It still puts they call it illusory control.
Right.
But it puts the control back into you and says, okay, wait a minute, then there's something that I can do about it, and I can change that. And that's really what the book really gets into is how do you change it? How do you diagnose, resolve, and prevent tragedy? And it's actually my first subtitle was How to Diagnose, Resolve, and Prevent Tragedy. And
right.
there's a whole chapter on how do you prevent it from happening.
So what was the process to actually launch the book?
Well, actually the truth is I wrote it two and a half years ago, and put it on hold while I created my other business.
Okay.
And went out about, found an agent. I've got a super agent. But even then, we went and met with McGraw-Hill about a year and a half ago, and we thought we were going to get a deal. And the publishing industry is a strange industry. So I decided, I put it on hold for a while I was so busy focusing on my business.
Yeah.
And then my dad passed away in December. And out of that, really, there was a couple things that kind of synchronicities that happened that made me think, I'm just going to go out and publish it myself.
Okay.
And I'm going to get it done.
Yeah, because, you know, once you told me about the book, I mean, the first thing I did was went and looked at Amazon, and at the time it wasn't there. And then I found it. Was it Libris? Is that where it was?
Ex Libris.
Yeah, Ex Libris. And actually, they actually create the books on demand.
Yes. Yeah.
So kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's on Amazon now, though. And if you went to the bookstore, you could order it, you know, anywhere. It's through a distribution company now. So.
Right. So what was that process like, deciding to go the self-published route? Because I'm sure there was some learning involved in that.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of learning on it. There's a lot of ways to go about that. There's the print-on-demand, like you're talking about, Ron, that I did. There also are companies where you can spend a lot more money up front, but you make more money on the back end.
Right.
And I, frankly, all my money was going into the business, so I couldn't afford that.
Sure.
And so, the publishing industry is a strange industry, not to belabor it, but unless you're really already successful in selling a lot of books, they don't want to talk to you.
Right.
But the thing is, if you're already successful in selling a lot of books, you don't want to talk to them.
Right.
Because you're making more money by doing it yourself than you would by talking to them.
Right.
So they're really hurting for that exact reason, you know.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So tell us about your next business.
Draw Success is my business. And a friend of mine is kind of a, you know, real close friend. We talk about all kinds of esoteric stuff. But she's like, you know, she knows that she keeps telling me, she knows I couldn't have created this game, and it's a game, as you know, Ron, because you patented it for me.
Right.
I couldn't have created it if I hadn't been through the experience of writing the book. And what's interesting about it, even where we are today with the business, and I started it 2.5 years ago when I first started inventing it, even with where it is, I keep more I get into it, the more powerful it is, the deeper and deeper and deeper it goes. I mean, just every day it seems to take another level of depth and power in terms of, in fact, our mission statement for the company is to change the world in a fun and profitable way.
That's a good mission statement. And who's the target audience for the game?
Well, primarily we're focusing initially on the corporate world, on corporate teams. It's a team transformation program, really.
Right.
It just happens to be centered around this game. And the game is the magic of it, but it's also a whole program for team transformation. And so we primarily are working with companies and corporate teams because that's really where a lot of the need is, and that's also where their money is.
Right.
We do have a plan to go into government, and then we also, of course, have a plan to get into education and make that happen as well. And, of course, international is also part of the plan.
So what was the process as far as the design and creation of the board and the pieces?
There's some things that I wanted to accomplish in it, and I went and read 3 books on game design and pretty much ignored them all, or game strategy, and ignored them all, as typical is probably something I would do, but I wanted it to make it non-competitive, and I suspect it's probably the first non-competitive game ever created. And because every game is about how do you win, and I really felt like a fundamental belief was that it was a competition within a team is divisive. And this whole point of this is to unite a team and give people a framework to discuss and open up.
Right.
So how do you know when the game's over?
It's designed to be facilitated by a trained expert facilitator. And so that's really what we are, is kind of a training company more than we are a game company.
Right.
And we train people on how to facilitate it and how to do it in a way to get at that depth and get at those answers.
How is it played? Is it a question-answer? Is it a draw on the board? Is it, you know, build a...
It's there are 5 kinds of questions within the game. You roll dice, you land on a square, you draw the card that matches the square, kind of like a Candyland.
Right.
You know, and some questions everybody answers at the same time. Some are brainstorming type of questions. Some are about a personal situation. Some are which of the following vanity license plates is most like you. I mean, there's quite a variety, or which are your favorite breakfast cereals when you were a kid.
So they're like conversation starter type things, or are they, Trivial Pursuit kind of questions, or a mixture?
There's not at all Trivial Pursuit type of questions. It's never about what you know in terms of, you know, any kind of trivia or any
right.
kind of knowledge.
It's about how you think or what you think?
It's about how you think and what you're about.
Mm-hmm.
So I learn more about, okay, if I find out Ron, let's say Ron and I worked together and we hated each other.
Right.
But I found out we both loved Cap'n Crunch as a kid.
Right.
It's going to change our relationship.
Right, just that little snippet, then you now have some common bond together.
Exactly, exactly. And then there's a brainstorming component. So there's a component to figure out why teams are or are not working, what new products or services a company could have, what problems that the company should be prepared to face in the future. I mean, it gets really, really deep. It just happens to be in the framework of a game, which, you know, talking to the learning experts, which is not what I came from, but right. is, you know, it uses all five learning styles within one experience because there are five ways people learn, and it uses all five ways.
Are those five ways?
They're auditory, right, because you're reading the question aloud. Right. It's kinesthetic because you're touching and rolling dice and moving around a board. It's visual because you're reading the cards, and it's a very visual and colorful game. It's metacognitive, which is means you think it makes you think through the answers of mm-hmm. the questions. So it's got a deeper level, and it's social emotional, which is the fifth type, which is really, you know, you really are able in a very safe way to open up about even things that annoy you with your fellow team members.
And I was aware of those first three, but not those last two.
Yeah, I got challenged on that. I knew about the first three, too.
Yeah, put you on the spot.
No, but I had somebody challenge me. We've been working with a very senior learning executive, and he was like, well, where are the five? You've got three. Where are the five? You know, what are the four levels of the change behavioral processes? So I'm like, okay, well, I better look those up. Oh, guess what? We do that. You know, right. So some of it was very, very accidental, but very, very happily accidental.
How did the game begin? Like, did you have an idea of I'm going to build this game initially, or you just started doing it and people liked it?
Yeah, no, I kind of had this idea, I want to invent a game. And then I said to myself, I want to invent a game for companies. And honestly, at that point, I'd never seen one. Didn't know they existed.
And you don't have a training background or that?
Not at all.
So you've never done this kind of corporate kind of get-together like this?
Never done any of it. I mean, as my team likes to say, you know, one of the big powerful thing about this is it was created by a business person for business people. And the training industry looks at it and just, like, it flips them out because they're like, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, it's so different from anything that they could learn and do. And so when we're meeting with somebody from training background, we have so many paradigms we have to shift.
Right.
But if we're meeting with a business person, we say, oh, you want to get results. You've got a problem. We'll identify the problem, and we'll get you results. I got it. I don't have to argue with that. I don't care about the five learning styles. Right. I just care about the results. Yeah,
they don't care how it's done, just so the results come. And I understand that you created a symbol that creates about change.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's on my website. ReasonsWhy.com is my book website. Mm-hmm. And if you look on it, it's very hidden, but it's on every page, is basically a symbol that says, I love change. And I want to do something to get that message out. Because truthfully, when people say, well, you got this book and then you've got this game, what in the world do they have in common? Well, actually, they both have change in common. They both are about what are you going to change, what are you going to look at, and being very conscious about it.
Do you think people do like change?
No. I think instinctively people don't like change. I think one of the blessings in a crisis is to get you to change something, though. And it's, you know, it's the old adage about, you know, sometimes you need to be pushed off a cliff to find out you can fly.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I think that's what a lot of people need.
Yeah, I know that my wife and I play a lot of Chinese checkers, and she says, you're so boring. You know, you use about the same, you know, the same approaches, you know, in order to get the marbles from one end to the other, and she's constantly experimenting. So I think she embraces change a lot better than I do.
Yeah,
I understand that you have a kind of a phrase that kind of focuses people on what they should be doing in a business and what they shouldn't be doing. Can you share that with us?
Are you talking about my three things I always tell an entrepreneur?
Well, that's good, but no, where I was going was not your genius.
Oh, it's not. I don't take credit for that quote, but I do like to use it. If it's not your genius, it's not your job. Was a really great quote that was given to me by a friend. And he's probably actually been on one of Lee's shows in the past. But it really does make you focus and say, if this is not something I do well, then I shouldn't be doing it while you're doing a business.
Right, because I know I've started sharing that with some of my clients, you know, that are down into the minutia of running their business. And I'm just like, you know, you need to get documented, repeatable processes and put that off on somebody else to do. And then I look in the mirror and says, Ron, I think you need to do that yourself.
Yeah, exactly. It's always easy to see in someone else what we need
right.
to do.
It's ourselves. So obvious in others.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's what I mean on my business. That's why I, you know, brought in a CEO and brought in a VP of marketing and bringing in a learning executive with that learning background, people with the expertise, because I like to laugh about and say I demoted myself to chief innovation officer. But truthfully, that's my genius, and that's what I should be spending my time on.
You know, even Bill Gates realized he should be chief technology officer, and somebody else should run Microsoft.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what are those three things that you tell entrepreneurs?
I always tell them that you need three things. You need to diversify, leverage, and residual.
And what does that mean?
Diversify means you need to have more than one thing going. And that not doesn't just mean you've got two businesses at the same time. It really means when one thing, the energy is waning, then you and your energy is lowering something that's going to build your energy.
Okay.
So it could be you're working on, like for our business, we could be working on a big corporate account, but let's make sure we're working on some smaller accounts too.
Okay.
So we're looking at multiple things, and that one can build a short-term revenue, the other one builds us a long-term reputation. And how do you do that? So diversify from an energy standpoint as well as from a product standpoint. Leverage means that you have other people making money for you. It's not just about you. It means that when you're out, you can take a vacation and there's still money flowing in.
Okay.
And then residual means you work once and get paid forever.
Okay.
Right? A book is the classic example of residual, right? You write the book and you sell it and however long it's out there and you could keep selling,
right.
You know, forever.
You're an author forever.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, it's been really great talking with you, Brownell. I think there's a lot of good nuggets for those wannabe entrepreneurs out there. So thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Lee.
All right. Thank you, Ron. And that wraps up another episode of Launch. And we will see you again next week.